Welcome to Variant Frequencies. Month to month, our podcast brings you fiction stories from a different channel. Sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and some odd bands in between. Visit us at www.variantfrequencies.com. Hello, I'm Rick Stringer. This is part two of our four-part gift from Matt Wallace, The End of Flesh. If you are new to our podcast, please go back and listen to part one. Now, on to our story. The End of Flesh, Part 2, by Matt Wallace. Pax has been put on the trail of cannibal killers, who have claimed a high-profile victim, the son of a controversial city councilman. His investigation brings Busboy face-to-face with Rosalie Borello, sister to the deceased, beautiful and enigmatic. Will she prove to be his strongest ally or his prime suspect?
The End of Flesh by Matt Wallace. Part 2. The Lady Shimmers. Pax figured the daughter would be sequestered with the rest of the family at the Borello townhouse, then found out there was a radio car assigned to shadow her. They were sitting outside the hot new raw vegan restaurant on 42nd and Madison. She had disappeared inside around noon and hadn't come out yet. Raw vegan was the new shade rich people used to hide the fact they couldn't afford meat anymore. Tired of looking like assholes next to even richer people who still could, the only posh move to make was forsaking meat altogether, like it was a choice. And Visser's was the new it of the Manhattan raw vegan scene, at least this week. They knew it, too. The maitre d' was less impressed by Pax's ID than he was by his $50 suit. He had his own badge, the laser-printed crest on his blazer, the same Gaia symbol beamed behind the Visser's sign out front. Apparently, he thought that trumped a police shield. Pax stared him down, gave him the cold silence. When the maitre d' asked him to leave, when he said, "Excuse me, sir," over and over, Pax didn't say a word. He just let the maitre d' stew in his own bullshit until he started to drown. He finally got so uncomfortable he just moved out of Pax's way. It was an old trick and a good time saver. Inside, the place smelled like a greenhouse. Pollen hit his sinuses like a bullet. They grew, harvested, and prepared all the stuff out in the open, in the middle of the restaurant. There were a lot of white-gloved pseudo-chefs with side carts and blenders. Instead of private booths, they had little glassed-in atriums with note-shaped garden tables. Rosalie Borello was seated inside one of her own, legs crossed over the edge of an ivory chair seat, a cup of something in front of her. The cup looked like it was made by a primitive tribe of natives who either had small stomachs or tiny hands. Pax had never seen a picture of the girl, who turned out to be a woman, and the one that should have been pixelated in more webzines than her brother. She wore a little cocktail dress, shimmering silver faded into purple, the satin so light it barely knew she was wearing it and vice versa. Her raven hair had that professionally jean-treated shine, strands and strands and even more strands of it that looked like they were being poured from a carafe. And dark eyes, black from a distance, like pools. He could have dived into them from where he stood. She didn't look sad to Pax, just lost in thought. Maybe the thoughts were sad. He rapped on the glass lightly with his knuckles and she looked up. His other hand was holding his badge. When Rosalie saw him, she tilted her head, considering Pax in a way that made him feel like he was the one cased in glass. Finally, she gave her little come-hither flick with her peach-round chin. "Miss Borello?" Pax said as he opened the door. "Rose." "I'm Detective John Paxson. I'm sorry to disturb you right now like this, but if I could ask you a few questions." "I was already interviewed by two other detectives, Andrea and Vine." Pax was going to correct her, realized he didn't care. Her voice was easy to listen to and hard to read. "I just need to follow up a few things for them," he said. She smiled. Her smile was hard to read, too. "You don't look like someone who follows up on other people's work."
"I don't?"
"You know how to spot a lone wolf, detective?" I'd imagine you look for a wolf that's all by itself, ma'am. Her smile got more amused. You watch how the other animals react to him. I saw you come in. It looked like your aura knocked that stick of his ass maitre d' over all by itself. Are you calling me a lone wolf, Miss Barolo? Rose, would you like a drink? They serve booze here? It's fermented malanga juice with an infusion of pomegranate extract. So you really go in for this return to raw vegan jazz? Rose shook her head. A good friend I met backpacking through Europe last year, her father owns the place. Since it opened, I've just found myself spending most of my time here. When we got the news about Donnie, I needed some place to hide, I guess. Now she did look sad, and Pax read it as true. I need to ask you some things about your brother, Rose. The other detective said this was most likely a random act of violence, some maniac arsonist. Donnie was just walking down the wrong street. We need to pursue all avenues here, Rose. She looked at him hard, staring through his jive the way Pax cracked the maitre d'. I appreciate being dealt with honestly, detective. I also insist on it. All right, honestly. It's possible your brother may have been eaten.
Eaten?
Either your brother was killed because of something he got involved in or because of your father. I'm looking to eliminate one or the other possibility. Donnie was a pure soul, Rose said quietly. No one met him that didn't walk away with a smile. There's nothing he could have possibly done that would make someone want to do that to him. I... She stopped. What's going on? Who really killed my brother? I don't have that yet. Will you find them? I always do.
Always?
I only do one thing, Rose. I better be good at it. So our family has an avenger. She looked him over appraisingly. We could do worse. Can I trust you to keep this talk between us? You can trust me, detective. The cloth was linen, grease-stained and reeking of gun oil and mothballs. Pax unwrapped the shotgun carefully, like taking a baby out of its swaddling clothes. The old police-issue Ithaca with its worn wood and scuffed steel comfortable in his hands. There was a rack filled with them in the NYPD wing of the Justice Museum, what used to be One Police Plaza. Some put their faith in arcane gods. Pax believed in the dependability of old-world hardware. In the 1930s, 52nd Street between 5th and 6th Avenue was home to the speakeasy. In the 2030s, it was all about the breakdowns, where they mixed biochem cocktails and sparked the ash of the dead, sucking its acrid smoke through bone pipes. The big ticket, of course, was shooting distilled endorphins. They'd found the last fix, and it was inside the human body all along. Pax shut the back lid of his car and tooled up 52nd with the cut-down stock of the Ithaca wedged under his right arm, hidden by the folds of his suit jacket, deadly stinger inside a wool blossom. He eyed all the staircases that led onto the sidewalk. After 5 or 6, he spotted the sign sprayed on the bricks at the top of the steps, the biohazard head with its pop skull cap, a straw sticking out of it, and a freaky little aboriginal drawing of a man siphoning from it. That was Fitter's favorite spot. At the bottom of the staircase, Pax found a burnt-out light bulb and a crimson door as thick and heavy as the lid of a tomb. In the dark, it looked like blood underwater. He sledgehammered it with his fist 4 times, staring into a small, dark depression set at the top of the door, where, a moment later, a holographic representation of the breakdown doorman's head bloated to the size of a plum, bald and meaty and tinted viridian.
"You got the words?"
it asked him, the doorman's voice broadcast in surround sound from speakers embedded in the cubbyhole. Pax stared at the hologram, as sheer and shiny as glass. He caught his curved reflection in it, just another one of the gaunt people, hollow-cheeked and sallow-skinned. Even city employees were on half-protein rations.
"Eat the rich," Pax said.
"That was last month. You want to try again or save us both some time and just get fucked now, cop?"
"How about bang? How does that work for you?"
Pax racked the Ithaca slide about the thunder. The breaching rounds picked the door's bolt lock apart with the fervor of a coroner on speed. He rammed it with a shoulder and the door lurched aside. The corridor beyond was more like an upholstered tunnel. The lush vermilion fabric stretched like an accordion over the walls gave the impression of a very large, plush rectal canal. The doorman stood 6'4", and all of it was cowering under the hollow imaging setup. Pax stroked the ethic slide one more time and leveled it at him. "Police! On the wall! Now!" The doorman grabbed two handfuls of the corridor's fatty lair.
"You got a warrant?"
the corner of his mouth asked. "No, and I fucking hate cliches," Pax said, introducing the back of the doorman's skull to the knotted mahogany fist at the butt end of his shotgun. Walking down the corridor, he felt a little like an endoscope. A few ripples of the breakdown's in-house muscle came hustling at him from the other end. Pax tipped the shotgun's bore and pumped around into the corridor's ceiling. Chunks of fabric and bits of stone rained down on their hip bone shoulder pads like bird shit from the sky. "On the floor," he instructed them, punctuating the order with another rack of the Ithaca slide. "I'm not here for your cash or your patronage." The muscle hit the deck and Pax stepped over them. A few yards up, the corridor opened into a converted sub-basement with fat stone columns that kept the whole shebang from caving in. Everyone who wasn't flopped for the night scattered when they heard the thunder. The rest were either too zagged out or cow-eyed with fear, thinking it was a raid. They were the dabblers. For some, the breakdown was a chaser. For some, an appetizer before the main course. But most went there to skinny dip in a wetsuit. Enjoy pieces without crossing that final line. The one where the flesh passes your lips and there's no washing the taste from them. He found Svitter floating in a gravity chair. "Bus boy!" Svitter was broadcasting from Dreamland. He'd probably been through a tasting menu of the breakdown's human chemicals. "Detective John Baxson," he announced to the rest of the breakdown. "Lone wolf of the Gary Candy scene. Nobody move!" Pax crouched beside the gravity chair, leaning his ethic against one of the stone columns. "How deep in the pool are you, Svit?"
"Say what?"
"You're supposed to be home nestled in your hack nest on my dime, not sacked out here up to your eyeballs in recycled biofuck."
"I... huh? What?"
"Where's Necrophagiac set up tonight, Svit? I need to know. I have to make up for all the leads you're not giving me."
"Ah, man, zero out the interrog. I'm too liquid to fold under questioning right now, BB. I'm..."
"Hey!" Pax flicked Svitter's closed eyelids. "On the clock, Svit, come on." It was useless. Fucking useless. Svitter was ass deep in the plasma pool. By the time he resurfaced, the sight would be dismal and any affairs would come too late. Pax skinned the sleeve of Svitter's acid-cured shirt. He hadn't updated the digitat between his wrist and elbow since yesterday. Most of the time, digital skin work like this was just a simple scrub job so bikers could replace some chick's name on their bicep. Svitter had the full mosaic treatment. Isochronous real-time updating, full laser printing capabilities. It even had its own bioport embedded in the crook of his elbow so he could customize it at his leisure. Pax knelt to rifle his bony frame and came up with a PDA. When he turned on the monitor, he found the system was locked, passphrase protected. He didn't have time to take it to someone who could crack the thing. Pax thought about Svit, what he knew about the kid, thought about his hack nest back at the apartment and all the dolls and lobby cards and wind-up toys that littered the desk. Svitter was a real vintage paraphernalia junkie, and he was predictable. It was worth a shot. "To Serve Man is a cookbook," Pax said. The PDA's monitor lit up. Spitter's head came flying at him from behind the screen. He said, "Don't try and spoof the alpha dog, Zag." He looked up at Svitter. If he'd been capable of feeling it, Pax would have given him a smack. Instead, he took another shot. "Soylent Green is people. Eureka." The jazz on the monitors dissolved and there was Svitter's operating system. He yanked the bioport plug out of the top and jacked it into Svitter's arm. He found the Digitat program in the PDA and accessed the update. As Pax watched, microbleachers in Svitter's pores cleansed the skin slate, then subcutaneous inkjet started filling it back in. A zigzagging red line snaked between freak symbols, a system of neoglyphs they used to represent landmarks. Svitter promoted for Necrophagiac. The Digitat was a map. The ghouls who ran it updated every night with new coordinates. Now all Pax had to do was roust one of these hopheads who knew how to read the freak symbols. She didn't belong in his neighborhood. tooling up the crumbling drag in her chauffeured next-year car between the ancient fossil burners that lined the curb. She didn't belong on his corner, with the horrors Pax passed every morning and night, all of whom he knew by name. She didn't belong in his building, lighting up the darkness that hid the shameful repair of the corridor with her luminescent skirts. But most of all, she didn't belong in his shitty little puzzle box without a solution of an apartment. Yet there she was when Pax came home to change for Necrophagiac, waiting for him inside, totally unexpected and out of place. It was like finding gold in your grandmother's attic. Rosalie didn't wait for Pax to speak, didn't bother with any formal greeting or any formalities at all. "I didn't think you'd want me waiting around in the hall dressed like this. You don't live in a very good neighborhood, Detective." She wore a different set of shifty metallic colors from the first time Pax met her, gliding from one cramped corner of the room to the other as if leading him around a grand ballroom. From directly above, the single light in the ceiling rolled off her form like champagne swirling in a bottle. There was no denying it. The lady shimmered. "How'd you get in?" Pax asked her. "The lock's been deactivated." "Oh," he nodded. "Well, the whole building knows what kind of cop I am. Nobody's gonna rob that guy."
"Which guy would that be?"
"Never mind. What are you doing here, Rose?"
"I wanted a status report on my brother's case.
I gave you all my numbers and addies."
"You sound displeased."
Pax sighed. He didn't like surprises, on the job or off. He particularly didn't like coming home to them. This was his one sanctuary. This single shitbox of a room was the one thing he could count on. But mostly, Pax didn't like where he was headed with this girl. He could see it, an old, old song whose refrain they rapidly approached.
"What do your friends call you?" Rosalie asked him.
"Pax. But I think I'd like you to call me John."
"I'd like that too."
"Why'd you really come here, Rose?"
"I wasn't expecting you the other day."
"You weren't expecting any of this?"
"No," she said, taking a step towards him. Pax glanced at her golden brown legs. "I mean, the first detectives I talked to, I'm used to that. They're men like my father, all business, steam-pressed and polished for the world. But you were unexpected. You're real, John. I don't meet many real people in this city."
"It's teeming with them."
"Not where I live. All the people are milk-fed and oblivious and polite in a way that makes you realize polite can just be another word for liar."
Pax laughed. It was fleeting, but it felt good.
"You said my brother may have been eaten. I want to know why."
She stood very close to him now. It helped Pax to think about business. It helped him to think about anything other than how much he wanted to touch her. "It started with overpopulation, famine, necessity, and most of the time it's poor people watching their kids starve."
"And the rest of the time?"
"I guess for some it's the last taboo. Those are the dangerous ones. The ones who think they're back in the trees, the jungle." It was no good. He watched a mental construct of himself caressing those bare shoulders. It was a cold night, but her skin would feel warm. He was sure of that.
"What do you think, John?"
"I think you eat somebody who doesn't want to be eaten, it's murder."
"Not in the jungle."
"This ain't the jungle. Not yet."
"You think you can stop it? One cop?"
"I'm barely a cop. And sometimes not even that."
"Then what are you?"
Pax remembered thoughts of diving into those dark eyes, the ones that were now staring directly up at him. He realized he'd already taken the plunge. "I'm a busboy." He forced over the lump in his throat. "I clean up the city's mess. I get sent on suicide missions with no backup. I keep people like you from finding out about what's really going on out there."
"There's more," Rosalie insisted quietly. "And that's what I want."
"What do you want?"
"You."
"I'm a skeleton in a cheap suit, Rose."
"You're real," she said, slipping her hand inside his jacket and resting it over his heart. "Flesh and bone."
She kissed him. It didn't taste of the vile weeds he'd seen her choke down in the vegan joint. She tasted sweet. His nostrils filled with the scent of her hair, her tropical blush, her skin cream. Pax never made it back out into the nasty night. The case would wait.
Thank you for listening to The End of Flesh, Part 2, by Matt Wallace. Check back with us in 1 week for Part 3. To find out more about variant frequencies, please go to our website at www.variantfrequencies.com. If you like variant frequencies, tell your friends about us. Thank you. From the Variant Frequencies team, Matt Wallace, Ann Stringer, and Rick Stringer.
It's something I don't really like to talk about, but I understand that it's important. And, well, you know, she stopped reading, and she just stopped reading. And then after that came the drugs and the loose men, as my aunt likes to call them, coming around all hours of the night when she should have been reading. And then she left, and I haven't seen her. I got an address. I think she married one of those loose men, and I hope he's tightened up since then. And, I have to do the intervention. I have to send her a copy of The Next Fix, because I'm hoping it will scare her back into reading. If the drugs and the whores and, you know, everything did not scare her enough, The Next Fix should show her what she's missing and should hit her in the jaw hard enough that she'll never stop reading again. So if you have someone in your life who stopped reading for any reason, you should get them The Next Fix, because that will jumpstart it. And I think we're all going to be a lot happier come the new year.
Consider this promo a controlled substance. Only one drug can bring the visceral and the sublime together in a single trip. Where the best and the worst of the human drive boils down into a techno-noir concoction that's half street-level heaven and half the fiery beauty of hell. From Matt Wallace, Parsec award-winning author of The Failed Cities Monologues, this is The Next Fix. Kick back to the strains of Earth's Last Top 40. As the final human DJ sends a shout-out over the last frequency, step into the hard-boiled beauty of the Lusting Corridor, where that which once escaped a man is met again. Tool up with a lone cop who polices the terrifying carrion underground of the future as you seek the end of flesh. Experience one of the most unique and captivating imaginations in fiction today, collected for the first time anywhere in print, and featuring 12 original stories and one full-length novella, The Next Fix, by Matt Wallace.
Hi, this is Merle Lafferty from I Should Be Writing and Playing for Keeps and a bunch of other stuff. But I just wanted to say that Matt Wallace is big like Bear. He is smart like Bear. And he writes like Bear. Scary stories that roar at you and make you look for the closest tree to climb. Maybe if you roll over and play dead, The Next Fix won't bite. Maybe.
Matt Wallace serves up two-fisted literary action, if, of course, your fists are half-cybernetic, the size of ham hocks, and covered in broken glass.
Hey, everybody. J.C. Hutchins, author of the Seventh Son podcast novel trilogy here. Matt Wallace is the boogeyman in your closet. He's the monster under your bed. He's the shadow that slides along the walls. Matt Wallace's writing is so compelling and so terrifying that you'll keep turning the pages, addicted to his work, questing for the next fix.
You order your copy today in limited edition hardcover from ApexBookCompany.com. Are you ready for the next fix?
In a world where evil supervillains run amok and corrupt superheroes care more about their hair than justice, one woman is caught in a web of manipulation. Keepsie Branson just wants to run her bar. She doesn't want to think about her old dreams of being a superhero or her tired ambitions to save the world. But the facts remain that Keepsy and her friends have powers too, and they will soon be needed as Seventh City falls into chaos, and no one knows who are the good guys and who are the bad. Playing for Keeps is a free audiobook from Murr Lafferty, available at playingforkeepsnovel.com.
Many were infected. Infected with a disease that thinks, a disease that talks, and as the victims finally succumbed, a disease that walks. One man fought back. He resisted the voices. Perry Dawsey carved out pieces of himself in a desperate attempt to survive. He won. But as Perry awakes in a government hospital, he realizes he can still hear those voices. It's not over. And now it's even worse, because the infection has become contagious. Contagious is the bloody sequel to Scott Sigler's horror thriller, Infected. Contagious is available in stores December 30th, or reserve your copy now at scottsigler.com/pre-order. Get the book the day it comes out, because if someone spoils the ending, you'll hate yourself enough to use the chicken scissors.